mic. Brack! It'll clear those loudspeakers out there. I think today, for those of you, we're going to give you a disclaimer right away before we go any further. This is going to be a show about Great Britain. And the reason that I'm doing a show about Great Britain is because I don't think that there is another country in the world that Americans have a more subconscious hang-up on today than Great Britain. Everywhere you look, Great Britain is taking over in all kinds of fields. The British actor, British pop music is beginning to be really a big deal in America. British movies, British authors, speaking of British authors, just by way of passing, C.P. Snow, who is a famous British physicist and writer. C.P. Snow was just the last day that I was in Britain, was appointed to the government. He was a famous writer. Of course, they do things that we don't do over there. One of the things they do that we don't do is include the people who are involved in the arts and letters, include them in life itself. We would never think in America, for some reason or other, we would never think in terms of sending Tennessee Williams to Congress. Well, maybe we have reasons, but kind of thing with Guy George. But, of course, oddly enough, many of the same reasons apply to writers in England, but they send them anyway. And maybe this is why England has a tendency to look like a gigantic bowl of Jell-O, very nervous at this point. But I just got back from Great Britain, and I had, I think, an unparalleled opportunity, an unparalleled, certainly in my experience, opportunity to study Britain from a very different side than most people ever get a chance to study it from. The tourist goes over there, and he's there for 3 days, and that's it. Or a man goes to Great Britain as a businessman. He lives in a certain area. He works with a certain kind of person. He meets certain type of situations. And he never really runs into the world that is really Great Britain. Except maybe perhaps as a casual tourist. Let's take the average American coming to a city like New York. What does he see of the life of the New Yorker? I'm talking about the great lumpin' proletariat life. I'm talking about the lump, the millions of people who spend their time swilling Pepsi-Cola up on the Grand Concourse and watching with mouth slack and agape, observing the Ed Sullivan Show. I mean, he never sees this side of it. You never see that side if you go to Cleveland. You just don't. Well, I had the opportunity to live in that side of Britain for 2 weeks. I lived with the Beatles. I was invited by the Beatles to live with them, to share their dressing room with them, to travel on the train and the planes and the buses and in their old Austin Princess with them on one-night stops throughout Great Britain, Dundee, Edinburgh. We played places like Glasgow. We went to Exeter and Bournemouth, places like Plymouth. These are all little way stops throughout the British Island, of course, with the exception of Edinburgh. You begin to get a feeling of a side of Great Britain that to me as an American has never been reported. You know, one of the problems with international relationships today is it seems to me that it is now getting to a point where it's one-way reportage. One way in the sense that there are dozens of British journalists reporting on America every day, ranging all the way from the well-known ones like Alastair Cook to little-known representatives of the Manchester Guardian who skulk up and down Greenwich Village streets writing back to the readers in Great Britain how rotten and decadent America is really getting to be. This is a great big... I wonder if you're aware of that as an American. Are you aware that one of the great British industries is excoriating the American? It is really a big industry. It's almost like General Motors in our country. Speaking of industry, why don't we take time out here for a commercial or two, and we'll be back with more talk about GB the way it is today. All right, now we're back in business here. And I have a good hot cup of American coffee sitting here in front of me, which is a rarity in England. I suppose you're aware that coffee, to find decent coffee in England, is literally as difficult as it is to find a living, live panda. They have plenty of coffee over there. I don't know what it is they do to it, but it bears a very strong resemblance to what my father used to use in his battery. It's kind of a battery acid. It's true, and no wonder the Englishmen all tell you, well, they prefer tea. Well, certainly you quickly learn to prefer tea in England, because the choice is very narrow. I'll tell you, if either that or you wind up with blue teeth. You drink enough of that British coffee, and it has to do something to your gut. But nevertheless, I'm sitting here with a cup of hot American coffee, and I'm not trying to be chauvinistic, but let me say this to you, if it's of any solace to you as an American. The single most chauvinistic people I have ever met in all my world travelers have been the English. Maybe a very close second are the French. They are maniacal in their belief that God created first Frenchmen and then all the rest. As a dirty trick on the French, by the way. And this is a belief that is also held strongly by the British. Although the British don't believe God created them. They believe they created the British. And they created God. As a matter of fact, when you go into a British cathedral, you have a feeling that God owes the British a great deal. And they let you know that. It's a very, very interesting thing there going on in Britain. Now one thing, though, that they always do is accuse all the other nations of what they are guilty of in spades. And so the first thing the Britisher will tell you, after having outlined all the niceties of British civilization, ranging all the way from British wool caps to the superiority of the British sock, and certainly by way of glancingly reference the superiority of British women, British men, British automobiles, British sky, British rain, British clouds, British jello, British everything, he will then turn to you and say, of course, the only difficulty with American, of course, is that they're so damn chauvinistic. And you get out your cello and you better start playing the same tune, or you'll find yourself turned out into Baker Street before you thought you would. Now, this is part and parcel of the British, and of course they love to hear about how bad other countries are. I was immersed in reading British periodicals, and I've always read them, as a matter of fact. I read The Observer and The Guardian and even down to The Mirror. Boy, if you think you have seen tabloid newspapers in America that specialize in axe murders, you know, the kind that says, I roasted my daughter for Thanksgiving, and I'm glad of it, you know, that kind of thing. Well, let me tell you, the British tabloid starts where ours stop, and they go from there. They go so far out, you would not believe it. And if you think you have ever read want ads that come right out and lay it out there on the line, what they're after, believe me, you have to get a British tabloid. You're sitting there constantly blushing, reading it. And yet you'll ride in a train, and a little old lady will be sitting there with a flowered hat and a print dress, and she'll be reading this fantastic, lurid tabloid, you know, that starts out, the front page says, gigantic sex orgy discovered in Middlesex. Pictures in, you know, and the use of the term Middlesex was not coincidental. Pictures, photo story enclosed, and the old lady will be sitting there looking at the photos and sitting and rocking back and forth, and you hear her girdle creaking, and there's a certain motherly quality about her, and you wonder just which side of her is real, whether the flower dress is real or whether the orgy photos on page 7, is this the real her? Well, I don't know. It's difficult. Like, I'm in a train, one of the most magnificent mornings I think I've spent in a long time was taking the train. I had to get up very early. I had to catch a train. The Beatles were playing in a town way in the south of London, which incidentally, you can tell as you go throughout, the south of England, as you go out throughout Britain, you can tell the cities that were hit badly by the war, because the center of the town is usually very new. All kinds of modern buildings, plastic, and you see all sorts of aluminum everywhere. And then you go to the next town, and you get this funny feeling, gee, what happened here? Because the next town looks like it was built sometimes just after the Dark Ages. Great chunks of granite and marble and ancient buildings, and the most modern building in some of these places is late Victorian. Well, Exeter is a town which was almost completely destroyed in the center of the city. It was a reprisal raid. The British RAF had attacked a German town, or a French town, I believe it was, that was filled with German soldiers, one thing or another. And so, as a reprisal, they attacked Exeter, which didn't have much in the way of military meaning. It was an ancient city, but they really blasted it. And so when you get into Exeter, you have this strange sensation of moving through concentric circles of time as you come into the town. Nobody hit the outside of the city, you see. There was nothing there to hit with the airplanes. And so you're going through what appears to be a very, very old, old British city. And then as the next thing you'll hit is a circle. You're in the middle of the most modern, ticky-tacky, nothing suburbs that have been put up in about 20 minutes out of erector sets. You get the terrible. The British suburb is probably the world's most ugly. The British don't really know how quite to be suburbanites, you know. There's only two kinds of people lived in England. There never was a real middle class, you know, in England. There was the upper class, of course, which we all know about, the aristocracy. And this is a part of Britain that all of us know. This is the part that is represented so well by Sir Laurence Olivier and Sir Alec Guinness and Dame Sybil Thorndike and Edith Sitwell and her brothers. They all represent that kind of rarefied atmosphere of the British aristocracy. And every time an American goes over and becomes part of the British world, he almost always gravitates to that. T.S. Eliot is part of the British aristocracy now, in spite of the fact he comes from St. Louis. He keeps that very quiet. And then, like most British aristocrats, he becomes even more British than the caricatures. He combs his hair real flat and wears bowler derbies. And he lives in the heart of the British establishment. He becomes more religious than the top Britishers can be. And he's fighting the same battles that Evelyn Waugh fights. He never refers to St. Louis. Well, this is what happens to an American who goes over there, the expatriate. Now, either that, or he becomes part of something else, which is British urban life, the upper class urban life, which is a kind of half-baked Manhattan underground underworld life. It's a strange life of sybaritic hedonism that is lived on a kind of level of Christine Keeler and Mandy Rice Davies and all kinds of rock and roll discotheques, and everyone's making money, and it's the room at the top world. Now, the one world that most of us never touch when we go to Britain is that great mass of people just walking around wearing lumpy overcoats, scratching, getting in and out of trams, and going to bed, getting up in the morning, going to work, and coming home, and going to bed, and turning on the telly. This world is rarely touched by Americans, and in fact is rarely even touched by Britishers in their literature, even in spite of the myth that most of us have that there is a now growing list of proletarian writers. There is not. Almost all the proletarian writers who write in Britain write out of the look back in anger tradition of Osborne, who writes about the British young college graduate who is trying to make it into the world of the room at the top syndrome. Well, there are millions of people who aren't trying for the top. What are they doing? Well, they're following the Beatles. That's what they're doing. They're drinking beer, following the Beatles, and playing darts. And betting on the pools. Following the Dugs. You know what is it, the Dugs? Every place you go in England, you see a little track, and it says night dog racing. And there you see millions of Britishers with their cloth caps. That's called the cloth cap Britisher, you know, of which I'm wearing one right now. He goes in with the Dugs. And one night, I'm in a cab, taxi, and I'm talking to a British taxi driver, of course, sitting up in the front there. And they're not used to people talking to them, you know. In America, everyone talks to the taxi driver. In England, they're very startled, and there's a sort of a feeling of uncomfortableness when you start talking to them, because the class consciousness is very strong. In fact, probably stronger today than it ever was. Because at least in the days of Dickens, they conceded that there was a lower class. Today they don't. They just ignored. And I'm talking to this taxi driver, and we went past this little... Oh, before we go any further, how about time for commercial here, huh? You want to hear what the cab driver said? Okay, let's listen to the commercial. We'll be right back. Well, we went past this sign on a dark country road, and it was a kind of a shoddy little orange and yellow sign, and it said Greyhound Racing every night, 8:30. And I could see the little lights off through the bushes down there where the where the lower class was engaging themselves. You know, nobody in the upper class even admits to the dog. It might be of some interest to you to know that the dog to the cloth cap Englishman or Irishman is the equivalent of the upper class Englishman's horse. That the dog is a thing that he can grow. He can own a dog and he can race a dog. He can race a dog as a sporting thing, and he gets the same. And oh, they have their equivalent to you. You're probably aware that automobile racing in the continent, throughout England, France, Germany, is an upper class thing. The little Britisher walking around the street feels no involvement with automobile racing. Not like they do in America here. It's the lower class goes out and watches the stock car races, and they go to Indianapolis and all this stuff. This is just a big mass of Americans who go to this thing. But in England, the racing, automobile racing, is definitely a class thing. And all automobile racers who race almost invariably are members of the upper class. You know, they knight them. Of course you know that. That many a British automobile racer is knighted, just the way Sir Alec Guinness is knighted. And Stirling Moss is one of the very top of the cream of British society. Why? Because he was a top automobile racer. And there are dozens of them like that. Dennis Ireland and so forth. These are very, very pursued. And these men, when they're not racing, can be found almost always wearing dress suits, attending premieres of top plays in the Mayfair Society. And they're really part of the top world of British society. Now what does this do to the little guy? Where does he go for his equivalent of that? Well, he is a fanatic, most of them, on motorcycle racing. The motorcycle race to the little lower-class Britisher is the equivalent of the automobile race to the top-flight European continental. And if you're anybody, you don't go to the motorcycle races. If you're nobody, you're a fanatic, and you go. And the men who drive these cars, these motorcycle these international competitions, and they're wildly dangerous, as you're probably aware, have no social status at all in the sporting life of England. Not a bit of it. They may be great, famous international motorcycle racers, but they're never considered on a par with John Surtees. They're never considered on a par with guys like Graham and people like Brabham, people like Collins and Stirling Moss. Oh, no, not at all. In fact, they don't mingle at all in the same world, even though they may be world champions. Once in a while, a man will make the transition. He will go from motorcycles to the big cars. And when he does do that, it's as though he's a Johnny-come-lately. He never quite makes it socially. No, he doesn't, because he's got this motorcycle past behind him. And so class consciousness is very strong in England, and it has subtle ways of expressing itself. Football, for example, is, of course, another one of the lower class fanatic objects. This is a thing that they really go greatly for. And on the other hand, you'll find most of the upper class people don't even know the existence of football, even those great stadiums outside of every major city. They will never concede it. Now, do they involve themselves in cricket? No. Oh, no. The upper class is not really, that's an older generation of upper class people, cricket. No, now they're involved in something else again. It's a kind of dynamic slumming. I can only say you can tell an upper-class man in England today by the degree of his fanaticism on what we call pop art. That the higher a man goes, the more he must be rabid about the Beatles. Oh, yes! I sat in a dressing room in Dundee when there was a timid knock on the door and a man dressed in livery appeared, and he was a peak cap and all that, and he said, excuse me, sir. And he was talking to the Beatles manager, and he said, the Countess of Strathmore is here, and she would dearly love an audience with the Beatles. Well, she had arrived for her audience with the Beatles. It wasn't the other way around. And do you know who the Countess of Strathmore is? She happens to be the resident of one of the greatest, most famous castles in all of the British Isles, Glamis Castle, which was built in 1067. She is the Queen's cousin and looks almost exactly like the Queen. And she came into the dressing room and sat there in abject humility and surrounded by the Beatles. She was showing her aristocratic background by being this. It's a fascinating reversal of roles in Britain. It's how to describe it. We could never imagine, for example, Lyndon Johnson, President Johnson, requesting an interview with Elvis Presley and coming in with his hat in his hand, and yet that is a very common thing in Great Britain today, the equivalent of it. Now why? Well, it's a kind of reverse snobism. Because it is very well understood when the Countess is in that room that she is the Countess. And she certainly never loses any bit of her Countessship. In fact, gains, if anything, and the sea, the audience parts before her like the Red Sea. There he is. She comes through with her retainers and her ladies-in-waiting and the retinue, and sitting out there in front of the theater is that magnificent 1927 Rolls, tremendous, with the crest on the wall, on the side of the on the door, and the whole business. She comes in with her lap robe being carried by her lady-in-waiting and sits down and says to the leading Beatle, she says, "And what is your name?" And he says,
"My name is George, like in King."
And she says, "Yes, indeed." And that was a typical exchange between the Beatles and the Countess of Strathmore. And now, on that delightful note from the British Isles, let us pause for a word from those who pay the bills. Oh, yeah. you get into Britain, or you want to hear about my taxi driver. Well, I'm sitting in the back seat of the taxi, and I saw this dog stadium there, off down in the weeds. It's very, very discreet. They don't have them big or anything, because the lower classes are not allowed to be very blatant about what they like. And the little sign says dog racing. So I tapped on the window. Of course, the British taxis, like our taxis used to have a very sharp divider between the front seat and the back seat. It's a big, heavy glass compartment. They have magnificent taxis, by the way. And I banged on the window, and he looks at me, "Aye, sir." And I says, "This is the dog racing over there." And he says, "Yeah, aye, sir." And I said, "Well, how often do they have?" "Oh, every night, sir. Every night, sir." And I said, "Do you go?" "Oh, every night on my day off, sir. Every night, sir." And I said, "Well, do you enjoy?" Of course, now he feels a little embarrassed yet, because I'm talking about something that most people, I guess, don't talk to the lower classes about, their entertainment. I could see that he was just beginning to be a little reticent. Is this guy putting me on or what? And I said to him, "What kind of dogs do they race there?" There's a pause. He says, "Greyhound, sir, greyhound. Shorter greyhounds." And I said, "Do they ever race whippets?" I was showing a real interest in the sport, see. And then he started to warm up. He said, "Oh, occasionally, sir, but they don't run well, you know. They don't have the stamina. No, they don't have the stamina on the stretch, sir. I had a friend, however, who raced a whippet in Dundee one night, and he didn't do well, sir, but good dogs. And we talked for about a half a mile or so on the various points of whippets versus greyhounds and so forth. And I could see that he was not used to talking to people in his cab about things like this. It was a definite class thing, going to the dog races, as they call them, dogs. Going to the dogs. And by the way, do you know that that's the expression when they say so-and-so is going to the dogs? Have you ever heard that expression? Well, going to the dogs means a man has slipped down in his social level. Believe it or not, that's an old English expression, which means that Fred is going to the dogs. That means Fred has become a lowlifer, and he spends his time at the dog races getting rid of his 10 quid every night, and is going slowly but surely down the ladder. And that term refers to dog racing. As you get into Britain more and more, you begin to realize that there are fantastic areas of Great Britain which the American does not know about. The areas, of course, involve such things as social mores. They involve things like newspapers. They involve his attitude towards the world. And of course, you know that the British, the low class British, is marked by one thing, a kind of wonderful, subterranean, insouciant irreverence, which is overladen at the same time by a peculiar kind of awe of the establishment. He will defend the establishment more than the British aristocracy, and at the same time he is peculiarly irreverent towards it. like the Britisher I'm sitting next to in the underground one day, and he's a working Britisher, and you can get into conversation very easily on the lower levels of British. And this might come as a surprise to most people who think of the British as reticent. It's only the upper classes who are reticent. They're extremely hard to get to know. And when you do get to know them, you always have the sense that they're vaguely putting you on. But believe me, you walk around the streets and you can get yourself into wild fist-fighting conversations almost instantly with the British lower class. He's a great man. He and the Scottish are great men to get in contact with, and the lower class Irish. And so we're sitting there, and he's looking at a picture of the Queen. Every newspaper, every day, by writ and by rote, and by a kind of tradition, somehow has to print a picture of the Queen. Did you know that? Even the highest British newspapers, you will see a picture of the Queen somewhere if you look carefully enough. And the lower you go in the British scale of newspapers, the more the Queen appears. Until finally you get down to the little lower class tabloids, and there will be page after page on the Queen's breakfast, what the Queen does in the morning, by some lady-in-waiting who's writing her memoirs. Something like Lady Margaret and the Pub World. And there is a whole thing about Lady Margaret dancing in the pubs. And they love to read about the British aristocracy, the lower class. And the lower you go, the more they're hung on this thing. It's not the other way around. In fact, I talked to one Britisher about the phenomenon of many of the British peers today are revoking their peership. You probably have seen this in the papers, or maybe you don't know about this, that one of the big issues right now in Britain today is a man who is Lord so-and-so, who decides he doesn't want to be a lord anymore. That's all. He just wants to be Charlie Brown. And this is a very hard thing to do. So they had to pass, especially if it's a hereditary peership. If it's hereditary, of course, you are saying something then about all the people who will come after you. And so if you're a peer today, you can turn it down. But you can't turn it down for your son. You know that? That you cannot revoke your peership. During your lifetime, you're no longer a lord, and your estates go into some kind of a trusteeship by the government, and then when the son is old enough and when the old man dies, then he can either take the dukeship or earlship or whatever it is and carry on, or he can revoke it, but it can never be permanently revoked. The only one who can do that, of course, is the crown itself. The crown can decide that this family has really gone to hell. friends, would you please tell them what radio station this is? I don't know how I got on this subject of the British aristocracy versus the British proletariat, but they're very, very strong over there in class distinctions. And the one thing that they resent about America is that facet of America, although they don't really quite come out and say it. I read a piece the other day, a very interesting thing to me as an American, a correspondent writing from America. Now, I believe he was in Chicago. I don't know what city he happened to be, but it was a Midwestern city, I'm sure. He was writing back to the British newspapers. He's a traveling correspondent. And he was really objecting to the fact that he had to go into a restaurant and wait in line. He objected very, very strongly to this. And he went on and he showed how the waitresses were insolent and all that. And all they did was say to him, you know, you have to wait in line, that's all. And he resented this very greatly. And coming through it was a thinly disguised sense of class resentment. He was mad that little fat ladies with girdles and flowered dresses and husbands who were smoking cigars could get a seat as easily as he could. He just considered this a part of the barbaric world of America, that these people, these pushy people, you see, what he means, of course, is that everybody in America has a chance. If you've got the scratch, you can get in line at the Four Seasons. You know, there are thousands and thousands of restaurants in Britain that the lower class, no matter how much he saves, no matter how he dresses, he wouldn't dare to go in. Are you aware of that? It's just traditional. He would not go to that restaurant. And if he showed up in that restaurant, he would be very politely told, they'd give him a seat, they'd bring him in there, but he would be made so uncomfortable that it would be just an impossible situation. And how can you tell? Well, there are many ways you can tell. A lower class, his haircut, for example. They wear their hair in a different way from the upper class. The cut of the clothes is different. The way a man wears his tie is different. The thousands of little ways that you can tell a British lower class. And this confuses a Briton when he comes to America, because he can't really quite tell who's important and who isn't. And this he considers a defect in the civilization. He considers this a basic flaw in our country. And yet, he didn't ever quite admit this, but he will, in the end, he will always talk about pushy people. When you're sitting in a club or a pub in England with a man of the upper middle class bourgeois or even the aristocracy, he will invariably get to that side. He will talk about these boorish people. And who he's talking about? He's talking about the middle class, which has very little voice in England. Just ordinary people who might have made a pretty good living and have been able to buy themselves a few of the luxuries of life. This is an unknown thing in Britain, but it's beginning to be a factor now. It's beginning to creep in, and it's being deplored on both sides. Who deplores it? Well, the little lower class Englishman deplores it. He deplores the rise. He's very resentful of his son who has gone out and has bought himself a new automobile. It's a terrible issue. You see letters and letters and letters to the editor of little tabloid papers deploring the fact that his son has been putting on airs. What'll I do about it? My son has decided that he wants to go to university and he will not follow my old trade of tinsmith. And how can I live with this? And then, of course, the answer also is, well, this is a changing world and you're going to have to put up with this rotten stuff that's happening. Goes on and on and on this way. In England, there is a great ferment. It's as though the whole country is blowing up. Now, as an American, when you get there, you find that you cut across all social barriers. You find that if you're a certain kind of America, you will be almost accepted among the aristocracy. Not quite, but almost. Because you are an American, and he can't quite tell who you are. And if you're over here talking to him, you must be somebody. So a lot of Americans who were really nothing in America have made it big among the aristocratic classes in England, merely by brass and cheek. Speaking of brass and cheek, I think it's time for a commercial here, friends. We'll be right back. Well, I found, though, that traveling with the Beatles, as I did, for those of you who don't know about this, I was sent over by a major American publication to do an article, not really about the Beatles per se, but about the whole maniacal, fanatical, strange development that this represents. It's a kind of world madness which sprang out of England and which really is at its most virulent in England. I wonder whether many of you are aware that what we call the lower type of entertainment in America is really the big entertainment in England today among adults and among grown-up walking around people. You know that rock and roll, it always surprises an Englishman to learn that rock and roll is just a thing that in America is more or less followed by kids. This is primarily who digs it. You know, kids, 10, 12, 15-year-old kids, and that's it. It surprises an Englishman to know that you are not, as an adult, thoroughly conversant with Elvis Presley's latest record. He's amazed. He thinks this shows a kind of ignorance on your part. He can't quite believe it. Then he thinks you're putting him on. He thinks, what are you trying to do? You know, you're trying to give me the business here? And I talked with many, many adult Britishers who are top journalists, people who are critics. This is what surprises you in the theater and that, who are absolutely, totally involved with the world of rock and roll, the world of comic strips, the world of the Beatles, that whole substrata of culture which in America we take so much for granted that we've kind of grown out of it. It's as though the Britisher has suddenly found that it is legal for him to now dig pop music. Well, you know, in America we've had it for years and years and years. And so we now can tell the difference between the good and the bad. They can't. Anything that's marked pop is great to them, just absolutely great. And they have very little taste. Just like on the other score, let's look at it the other way. The English have had fine things in the aristocratic tradition for many, many years. So they can tell the difference between a well-cut coat and a badly cut coat. They can really tell that shading, that subtle difference between a finely cut shirt and a clunky shirt. They can. They can tell the difference between a well-made boot and just a plain, ordinary chunk of plastic and leather. You know, they can. Americans are just coming into that. You know, we're a frontier society pretty well. And so the American taste is often very shaky when it comes to fine things. He can't tell a fine car, for example. The Britishers can. They've had great automobiles in their world for a long time, and he's not fooled. He can tell a great automobile. Americans, not quite. And now, on the other scale, because we've had such a great pop culture over the past 100 years in America, we can tell the good and the bad right away. We really have a peculiar inbuilt taste for what is a good musical and what is a bad musical. Americans will stay away from a bad musical in droves, not the English. The English can't tell a good musical from a bad one. And so if you've written a bad musical, take it to England. You'll make it big. They can't tell the difference. They really can't. As long as there are 15 guys out on the stage and the band is going, they think it's great. They'll tell you, isn't that great? And some of the world's worst musical movies are still great works of art in Britain. They love them. Movies that played 3 days in America and just died. You know, some of those awful Doris Day, some terrible old Bing Crosby movie. In England, they're still lining up for blocks to see it. And who knows? Speaking of pop art, we in America have made, as part of our pop art, the commercial. We have carried the commercial to the finest degree of artistry. In fact, more money is spent in America producing commercials than ever they ever produce books and plays, believe me. They'll spend $75,000. And incidentally, it might interest you to know, Nat, now that you're holding that up, that most Britishers resent that image of Britain. Are you aware of that? They consider that American slob attitude toward Britain. They'll say the beef eater tradition. They say, oh, that beef eater tradition. That's like that's the equivalent of the Uncle Tom in our racial situation. That's the equivalent of calling an American a kind of a Daniel Boone. You see, the Britishers really resent the beef eater image that they have in America. Because it's totally untrue, that image, completely. It's as untrue as if Britain were to think that everybody in America is Fess Parker and goes around wearing a coonskin hat, you know, and the thing hangs down between his shoulder blades. Speaking of the primitive and the great American folk art, the commercial, let's pause here to be totally American. Well, traveling with the Beatles gave me a kind of entree. It gave me a genuine entree into a world that has been and is, for the most part, remains locked to Americans. You know, you walk into a really low-class pub or something in Dundee or Glasgow, and you're going to be looked at with great suspicion if you're an American. Immediately they see you're an American. Your clothing, the way you talk, everything else. And there is a kind of great wave of suspicion. But you come in with the Beatles and the Beatle managers and all these guys. You know, surrounding the Beatles are a class of men who have come out of the same world that spawned the Beatles. This is the low-class Liverpool world of the docks and the dock wallopers and the truck drivers. The Beatles came out of that world and are still part of that world. You know, to the people who think of the Beatles as little animated dolls, little guys who wear little Victorian suits and have a kind of good, clean, Etonian attitude, you are in for a real shock. The Beatles reminded me, and I must be personal here, because I spent my early youth working in a steel mill in Gary in East Chicago, Indiana. Hammond and Whiting, Indiana. It's the great steel complex on the south side of the lake down there, hanging down in Indiana. And immediately after meeting the Beatles and getting to know them, I fell into a jargon and an attitude that I had lost ever since I left the steel mill. That my mind switched back to the mind that I had when I was working on the chipping dock and working down on the open hearth and the 40-inch soaking pits. And it was a real world. I mean, a world of real problems. There was nothing cute about it. There was nothing humorous about it. But the humor that comes out of a laboring man working at the bottom of the 40-inch soaking pits, which is a kind of disdain for the top, a kind of tongue-in-cheek attitude towards all authority, This is the world of the Beatles. And we think of it as we think in terms of them as being creative comics, comedians with a great... They're not. It's probably the first time in a long time that four laboring class guys have made it big on the world entertainment scene. And so we misunderstand them. We think of them as great creative humorous and so on. Well, let me tell you this. I could take four guys out of the chipping dock in Inland Steel. If I could get them on the Ed Sullivan Show, they would be a fantastic smash hit. They really would be. Speaking of the basic primitive, once more for the commercial. And so I felt a great rapport with the Beatles, but not on the level that the Beatle fan feels. It's a curious dichotomy to realize that most of the people who dig the Beatles in America are kids who have never known anything about the world that the Beatles grew up out of, and the attitudes that, of course, were entailed in growing up out of this rough, tough, laboring world attitude. This world of real, genuine labor. Most of the Beatle fans that I have known have been the pampered kids. They're the kids who live in schools where on every corner of every hall there's a psychiatrist who deals with the job evaluation of the future life of this child. It's as remote from the world of the actual Beatle as you are from Alice in Wonderland. And the Beatles know it, you know. They walk around in their dressing room, they look out, and once in a while one will spit in the spittoon. I'm a Beatle, how you like that? And he looks out, oh yeah! And Paul will say to Ringo, hey Ringo, why don't you pass a miracle? Why don't you pass a miracle? Hey Ringo, walk on water, you're a Beatle, you know. Oh man, it's a different world.